Today, I have a very special guest, and if I seem to be a bit awkward during this interview, there's a very good reason for it, and that is that I'm talking to, this afternoon, one of the greats in the radio business. And so, you know, I may not measure up to the experience that this man has and to the type of radio personality he is. If you have children, teenagers especially, you will know my guest very well. If you don't have teenagers and you watch morning cartoons or you are familiar with the voices on commercials, then you'll recognize my guest. And if you are involved in ecology, vegetarian diets, human interest, betterment of the planet, then you're going to know my guest. I have the great privilege this afternoon of talking to Casey Kasem of America's Top 40. Casey, welcome to the show.
Well, Dr. McDougall, thank you very much. I appreciate that terrific intro.
You're quite a rebel as far as certain social issues, and I don't mean just issues concerning food, which we're going to talk a lot about this hour, but there are a lot of social issues that you've become involved in, as I understand.
You're right, and I like the word rebel, by the way.
Go ahead.
I think that any time I can do progressive things and shake up part of America that perhaps needs a reminder that there's a lot to be done here in this country to make things better for people who aren't as fortunate as I am. And some of the things that I do, I think are very important, much more important than the radio show or the television show that I do or anything else that I do. And I think right at the top of the list is the basic thing. And, of course, the basic thing is to hopefully stop people from killing anything, and to begin with to create a nonviolent diet for themselves, because a nonviolent world has roots in a nonviolent diet. And I don't know who said that first, but there's so much truth in it. And then maybe we can think about solving our problems without violent wars, and to solve our problems diplomatically.
Well, this type of nature that you have, I mean, did this somehow come out of your upbringing?
I've always had a strong belief in a God or the first cause or whatever you may call it. My parents, my mother in particular, would always say the words in Arabic, Inshallah, which means if it's God's will. Mm-hmm. And I was brought up with a strong sense of something that was bigger than anything, and sort of a guide, a conscience. And so when I was about 15 years old in Michigan, and it was the end of the war, I remember going to a slaughterhouse where I saw one steer slaughtered before my eyes, and it was really, truly unbelievable what I'd seen. And I didn't eat meat for 3 to 6 months. Hmm. But there's the saying that I'm sure you know, that George Bernard Shaw once said, and that custom will reconcile people to any atrocity. And I customarily went along with everybody else and believed that it was wonderful to eat a juicy cheeseburger. And before long, watching television and listening to the radio, et cetera, and seeing the ads, I went back to eating meat. But I knew that one day it would stop. And in the 70s, probably 73 or 4, I remember one day saying to my wife, this is the last time I will ever eat a piece of meat, because there must be a relationship between eating meat and cancer. There just has to be. I don't know why. I'm not an expert. I've never read anything on it. I said, but I just know that there's a relationship. And not only that, I said, I've always wanted to be a vegetarian. I've always felt guilty about eating something that had to be murdered. And so I stopped. And from that day on, and it must have been 72 or 73, I don't remember the exact day, I hadn't eaten meat, fish, or poultry. And the only reason I went back to hard-shell fish is because I let a nutritionist tell me that I needed more protein. Mm. Well, I went back to that for about a year, and then Vegetarian Times interviewed me in a cover story about, I guess, 5 years ago, five, maybe more, and maybe it was 10, about 8 years ago, and they asked me, well, why are you eating hard-shell fish? I said, well, they don't have a nervous system, so I figured that's okay. And she said, are you sure? And I said, no. I said, I know what you're telling me, and I quit. I'm not going to eat anything from a fish as well, and so I quit. totally. And then I was very fortunate as the co-chair of the Great American Meetout, and that must have been 4 or 5 years ago, to talk to Dr. Clapper. And you know Michael Clapper,
sure.
The nutritionist.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me why I should become a vegan in about 3 hours before the March 20th day when I would be doing interviews, etc., about the Great American Meetout. And that's the day I became a vegan and have been ever since.
So 4 or 5 years you've had no animal products in your diet at all?
As far as I know. Now, I'm sure that I've gone into restaurants where I've ordered vegetables steamed, and they may have put some butter on it and I didn't realize it, or in maybe a piece of bread I may have eaten that
sure.
should have been made with some milk. But I have made an absolute conscious effort not to eat anything from an animal.
Well, the thought is certainly there. But as a personality, as somebody who rubs elbows with the rich and famous across the country, don't they look upon you as rather strange?
They did, I think, in the 70s. And then in the 80s, people began to change, and nobody was laughing anymore. And they could understand when I began to talk to them why it was that I was doing what I was doing, and it made sense, particularly the health aspect. The ethical aspect, they didn't always understand and seemed to always have a quote or two from the Bible or something that would tell them that was okay to do, and their conscience was eased. But for health reasons, they began to break through. And, of course, today, when you speak to somebody, they feel that you've been on the cutting edge and that you have been a pioneer and that you were right all along.
That must make you feel good.
Yes, it does. It makes me feel good because I feel I've planted some seeds in the minds of some others, and many others have become vegetarian because I've sent them books or because I've talked to them or because they've learned a little bit more about it. And my two children, I have four children, a baby from my marriage with Jean Kasem, and I have three children from a first marriage, and they're all teenagers, and the two girls are vegetarian, and one of those girls is vegan.
For the same reason?
And that was on their own. It wasn't something that I had to force them to do, I guess setting an example was enough, and they feel much better for it. They would absolutely not eat an animal. They also are pioneers, and with their friends, they often talk about it, but nobody is laughing at them.
Well, that's great. Didn't you ever worry about the health of your children? I mean, here you know, as an entertainer and not a nutritionist or not a doctor, not familiar with the medical literature. I mean, you took a big step there, taking not only your own health, which, you know, people have no trouble abusing and changing all the time, but you took something very precious, and that's your children, and you allowed them to eat a diet that, it sounds to me, you weren't quite sure about nutritionally at one time.
That's true. As a matter of fact, I knew nothing about the nutrition before I spoke to Dr. Clapper, and that's when I began to really understand a little bit more about it. One of the things that I'm very careful to do, and that is I know that I can get all of the protein and all the nutrition that I need in vegetables and in fruits and legumes, of course, and nuts. And so I do worry about the one thing, and I've decided finally on vitamin B12 to take that
nutritional yeast?
The little jar that I keep in my refrigerator.
Spirulina.
Nutritional
yeast, sure.
Yes, and I do that, and I spread it on my vegetable soup, or I put it on a potato
mm-hmm.
once or twice a month.
Well, that's good. It takes you 20 to 30 years to run out of vitamin B12, so make sure you do this every day. Well, you know, I understand, you know, and as I see it, just as I'm understanding your discovery of better eating, realizing that there is a healthier way to eat, that you don't have to eat animals to get protein, you don't have to drink milk to get calcium. As a matter of fact, if you take that behavior, you risk your life. The last holdout, and we're going to hear more and more about it, the last holdout in this country among nutritionists, diehards who want to continue eating these animal products, is the issue of vitamin B12. And they're going to be bringing it up more and more, and of course you and myself and the rest of the people in the country need to know the whole issue behind this B12 thing, and that is that your risk of getting B12 deficiency is probably 1 in 1 million or less. And if you do get it, you get a mild reversible anemia, you get a nervous system problem rarely, which is reversible until late stages, and if you stopped eating all B12 today and you were going to be that 1 in 1 million person, it would take you 20 to 30 years to run out of your stores of B12. Now compare that with your risk of dying of heart disease, which is 1 in 2, and your risk of getting a major cancer, which is 1 in 3. I mean, there's just no comparison. So,
well, I you know, and what is so terrific today is the idea that as a vegetarian, you're not only making a contribution to the animals, but also to your health, but more importantly now, the safety of the planet. And I'm happy to say that I just finished narrating about a month ago the new book by Harvey Diamond called Your Heart, Your Planet.
Yes.
Harvey and his wife Marilyn and I narrated that on tape. And also I did narration for Fit for Life with John Robbins on his book.
Mm.
And
Diet for a New America.
Yes, Diet for a New America.
Yes.
And I'm so happy that in some way now I've been able to use my voice as a spokesperson for vegetarianism, and I would hope that one day I could create either a television show or a radio show on the lines of what you do on television and radio to perpetuate this idea that we can help ourselves and our health, and of course do even more for the animals, and that is save their tortured lives, and then at the same time save our tortured earth.
Do you worry at all, or has it been a time that you've worried, that your outspoken manner as far as issues of vegetarianism and the harm of eating meat, especially when it impacts industry so greatly, could cause you physical harm or harm in the industry?
Physical harm I've been concerned about in another area, but not necessarily in the area of my being a vegan. I have been outspoken. I've done shows as long as 2 hours talking and even debating somebody from the meat industry, as unqualified as I am, but I speak from my heart, and I think that's the best way to speak anyway. And because of that, I know that there are probably people on Madison Avenue who are now very familiar with the things that I'm doing on radio and television, etc. Tomorrow I'll do a television show with Jesse Jackson. You know the Jesse Jackson TV show?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, Jesse, for the first time, is going to do just a personal interview on his show without an audience of me and my wife, Jean.
Mm.
And 10 years ago, as a matter of fact, this coming Friday is the anniversary of the day that he married the two of us, or officiated at the wedding.
Oh.
And I am going to be trying to convince Jesse to become a vegetarian. And so I know that Madison Avenue and people who would be potential employers for commercials, and even people who would be potential sponsors for my radio and television show, must know that I am a vegetarian and that I'm outspoken and that I don't believe people should be eating meat, fish, or poultry. For many, many reasons, if not just the one basic reason, that is that if you eat the animal gets back at you by killing you, and does it to the tune of over 1 million people a year through heart disease. So I just feel that that's much more important than whether I do another commercial or whether I get another sponsor for my radio show. And I know that in some way it may be selfish what I'm doing, because after all, my radio show involves not just me, but the network that carries it, etc. But I'm very fortunate. I have somebody who is the president of this network, Norm Pattis, of the Westwood One Radio Network, who understands the issues that I deal with, whether it's the issues of the Middle East or anti-smoking or anti-drug or being a vegetarian. And he says that's my prerogative, and I have that right as an American. So I have a good... I work for good people who understand that, and I can say that because of one of the issues that I've dealt with, there has been someone who canceled on a radio show, a network radio show. I won't tell you who the sponsor is, because it would be surprising, but it has happened.
Well, do you ever censor who puts commercials on your show?
Do I ever what?
Do you ever censor? I mean, do you have somebody from the liquor industry or the beef industry wants to advertise on Casey's Top 40?
No, we don't have censors, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
Because one thing that I won't do is I won't do commercials for, for instance, I've turned down milk commercials, shoe commercials. Even though I'm not an ethical vegan, I still wear leather shoes. but I still have turned down a shoe store that wanted me to be their spokesperson on television on their commercials.
Right.
And also I've turned down on TV and voiceover commercials, I don't know, probably 30 or 40 possible sponsors, from fast foods to supermarket chains, national supermarket chain, that wanted me to be their spokesperson. And because I would have to eventually talk about meat or cheese or milk, I chose not to do it. So, but on the other hand, on my radio show, because I have that arm's length situation where I do not endorse, I do not say, this hour is brought to you by carnation milk or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that I've positioned myself in such a way that there is no endorsement there, and so I certainly can't let the network go under and tell them that they can't sell spots to whomever, because that's not in my contract.
Sure.
And they would either get rid of me, or they would have to get rid of me, because they would find it very difficult. But I can still be outspoken, and I have a feeling that because I don't do a hands-on sale, that I'm headed in the right direction, and I'm doing what I can for animals and for the earth and for my sense of ethics.
Well, certainly getting yourself off the national radio network is not going to serve animal rights or human health any better, because you will no longer be in a position to be a spokesman.
That's true. And if I thought there were a way that I could, and if I thought there were a way to circumvent that, I think probably I'd sacrifice a lot more than I'm sacrificing already.
Very good. Finding out how one man has decided to try and make a difference in the area of human health and animal health, but I get the feeling, just from talking to you and the little bit I know about you, that really animal health came long before human health concerned, didn't it?
It certainly did. Conscience told me there was something wrong with slaughtering animals, and told me early, as at the age of 15, that there was something wrong with this. But even going back further, you know, when I was a child, and I do believe in reincarnation, when I was a child, I couldn't eat meat. And my mother insisted, because, of course, she listened to the dairy industry and everybody tell her, her doctor, of course, that I had to have the basic four. And I would sit there for a long time. And I was late to school as many as 67 times in one semester because I just didn't like meat, and I couldn't eat it. But, of course, custom allowed me to learn to like it, and I eventually, up until the time I was 15, ate it and enjoyed it, and then I saw the steer slaughter.
Well, did you ever tell your mother that it was too hard to chew?
I don't know that I told her that. I told her that I just couldn't swallow it.
Uh-huh.
It didn't smell right. It didn't taste good. I felt that I didn't know as a child, of course. I probably didn't think twice where that that meat came from.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember as a kid myself, I didn't, you know, have the same kind of feelings you did, but I just remember telling my parents many, many times, I cannot chew this. And what they should have said to me, instead of saying, well, John, you have to chew it to get your protein, you have to eat that before you eat your vegetables, and that's what they said, what they should have said is, of course, John, you can't chew it. You have the wrong kind of teeth.
Right.
But that's not what they told me.
That's not what they told you, but I certainly have told that to my children.
You know, I was also raised in the Detroit area.
I know that.
Oh, you
and
do?
You were in Highland Park.
Well, Dearborn.
Oh, Dearborn, that's right.
And I went to Michigan State University, and before I got into medicine, I was a pre-vet student, and I took the classes of animal husbandry, and I had the displeasure also not of seeing just one cow slaughtered, but of going through a slaughterhouse and learning how to grade meat and, you know, getting the whole procedure all the way from on the hoof and breathing to hanging up on a hook.
Oh.
And it was an interesting experience, I have to say. I didn't have all it takes at that time to come to the kind of conclusions that I could have come to, but it didn't feel good, and I didn't end up in veterinary medicine, and I think that's at least part of the reason.
Well, I believe, and I say this in interviews that I do on radio and television, that if in the fourth or fifth grade children could take a field trip to a slaughterhouse, we wouldn't have to worry about people becoming vegetarians. I mean, it would be just automatic. It would happen in a day. those kids would get such an eyeful, and their teachers as well, that they're, by the turn of the century, we'd have not 15 to 20 million vegetarians, we'd have a billion vegetarians all over the world.
It'd be socially disgusting to eat meat, just like it's socially disgusting to smoke cigarettes in public these days.
Yes.
I can see that, but unfortunately, you have children, I have children. They go to school, and what they're confronted with is the basic four food chart on their wall, which teaches them that the most important thing to eat is dairy products and meat products. Then they go to the school cafeteria, which is the dumping grounds for every bit of excess product from the meat and dairy industry that this country produces. And what chance do our kids have?
That's so true. And when their teachers, the people that they respect most, encourage them to eat that kind of food, and nobody is there to tell them that it's not necessary, and that they're eating food from tortured animals, and that they should be rebelling, and they should be calling attention to the fact that animals, it's one thing that they get killed and slaughtered. That's for most of them, that's the best thing that could ever happen to them. But they lead tortured lives, and in protest against the animal industry, the animal agriculture industry, we have to stand up and let people know why it is that we don't eat cheese and we don't eat milk, aside from the fact that it's not healthy for you, how very unhealthy it is for those animals that have just become products. They're not beings anymore in the eyes of the people who produce them.
What are some of the more shocking things that you've discovered in the animal husbandry industry?
Oh, let's begin with the chickens. Put in those cages that are no bigger than a folded newspaper, and chickens have pride and a pecking order, and when you consider that they're in there, some of them without beaks, some of them with beaks. Those that have beaks, of course, cannibalize the others because they need room to move. They can't even move their wings, and of course their feet are get entangled in the wire, and then there's one metal cage, wire cage, set upon another and another and another and another, and the feces falls on top of the heads of these creatures. Then, as they're born and they happen to be born a male chicken, they're thrown into a plastic bag, and they suffer, and not suffer, but they suffocate in the bodies of their brothers, and then the female chickens automatically their beaks are put into a metal machine that cuts the beak off, and some of those don't survive that. And they're made to create eggs, and then ultimately become food for animals, I guess, if not human beings. That's just the chickens. Then you have the pigs. The pigs are stored very often the same way, in concrete buildings that are warehouse size. And then, in order to keep the floors of the building clean, they use ammonia. Well, we know that pigs are much more sensitive in smell than humans are. And could you imagine living your entire life smelling ammonia day in and day out in a darkened room? Children don't know that those pigs don't get out and play in the mud, but those pigs are just products and treated like inanimate products. So they lead tortured lives and look forward to dying, of course. And then you have the calves in their 2x4 prisons, where they have no opportunity ever to feed on their mother's breast. The animal is immediately taken from the mother, and the calf is put into this little stall, and not allowed to suck on anything, but just fed milk, so that the price for their bodies can be a lot higher as they sell milk-fed veal to customers at restaurants that come from these calves. And the mother, the cow, never seeing their offspring, but being artificially inseminated again and again and again, so that their udders will be full because they're impregnated. And that means more milk for the dairyman. Their udders so big that they're just not hanging, but literally on the floor. And they, too, hardly ever see the sun or the grass or a graze. this is, and it goes on and on and on for all kinds of animals, not to mention the ones that are being experimented upon. So this is my priority, and I feel that if I do nothing else in life but can turn a few people around, I can do a lot to help the animals and their tortured lives.
You know, they do a lot to disguise the story that you're telling people about. You know, they don't call it eating a cow, they call it eating beef or a steak.
Right.
If people, just hypothetically, people were required to kill their own animal, to dress it, they were required to eat the animal, or eat the animal without any cover-up, the ketchup, the A1 steak sauce, the heavy salt, and so on, I bet you'd just get a lot of people to change right then and there.
No question about it.
If they had a little more direct
contact. I can't put a worm on a... when I was a child, that was another thing that bothered me, and that was when I'd go fishing with an uncle or... a relative that loved fishing. I couldn't see how they could take that worm and put it on a hook. That just seemed like the most terrible thing you could do to something that was living and moving.
Yep. There are even people, and I know that it's going to be real hard for folks to relate to, because it is a little hard for me to relate to this one, but I've had people on this show like Neil Bernard, the Dr. Bernard,
yes.
Who is concerned even to the point of the way honeybees are treated. And I don't know. I mean, do we get that far as concern for other animals?
I think what we have to do is take the first step in a journey of 1,000 miles. And unless we take that first step, then we'll never accomplish anything. If we become the kind of people who say, well, I'm not going to vote because my vote doesn't count, then certainly your vote won't count, and certainly the world will not change, and certainly things will not get better. So we have to begin somewhere. And
so
I think even people who might be listening to us now, Doctor, who are a little bit revolted by some of the things that I may have said about the animals, because it is not a pretty picture.
Hopefully they've heard it before.
Hopefully they have, and they're saying, you know, maybe I can just stop eating meat.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I can just back off eating meat, fish, and poultry by 10 or 25%. Well, what can happen if you stop eating meat and you're a Californian? You will save between 2,000 and 2,500 gallons of water a day for the state. 85% of the water in the state of California is used by the animal agriculture industry. If the people in California were to back off by just 10%, do you see how much water we could save? We would never have a shortage of water here.
I can take that brick out of my toilet.
Pardon me?
I can take that brick out of my toilet.
You can take showers for as long as you want. You can forget about brushing your teeth and having to worry about leaving the water on.
Uh-huh.
You'll be saving so much water that we'll have more than we need in this state, and we can help some of our neighboring states with water if we just backed off by 25% on eating meat alone.
Leslie, I never hear that as a recommendation. They're telling me how to save a few ounces of water with the recommendations that we just mentioned, and yet you're talking about saving thousands of gallons of water a day.
Exactly.
Just by changing our dietary habits. Why don't they have that commercial?
I haven't seen
television?
That one, and I haven't seen this one. The fact, for instance, that it takes to create one steer from the beginning of life to the end of that steer's life enough water to float a destroyer. Enough water.
Yeah.
Is that unbelievable? And it takes...
And that's a short life, too. I mean, these steers are slaughtered at just a little over a year, aren't they?
That's right. And when you consider how little water it takes to raise a pound of grain, it's just enormous. It's 2,500 gallons of water for a pound of meat. It's 25 gallons of water for a pound of grain.
Hmm.
There's the difference. And we are now thinking about rationing water here in California, certainly in Southern California, because there's a shortage.
How do you answer people who say, okay, you got a point, but look, you know, I'm a beef farmer, I'm a dairy farmer, you're ruining my business, you're destroying my family. How can you do that in good conscience just for a few cows and a few chickens?
Well, I would say that people who are in that situation, I think a lot rests on their conscience, and I think they're already suffering. And I really, my heart goes out to them. I like to think that as I grow older, I'm becoming a more forgiving person of myself and of people around me. And I would just suggest that they learn as much as they can about what is happening to animal life here in this country, what it's doing to the ecology, what it's doing to the health of people. And if they can still circumvent their conscience after learning about it, well, then maybe it's just going to take more time. And I know that they're put in a position where it will mean hitting their pocketbook should they leave that industry. But if they can find a way to find something parallel to do that doesn't kill animals, that doesn't torture animals, or if they can even become more humane in the way they treat their animals, in the way they deliver them to a slaughterhouse, in the way they treat them. Some in factory farms, of course, are, we're talking about an industry that's corporate and international. But you're talking about the small farmer. At least they can have the joy of knowing that if they do have animals, at least their lives are not tortured. So I would hope that that the small dairy farmer, I would hope that those that have anything to do with animals, the sentient beings that ultimately go to the slaughterhouse for people to eat, would at least consider a beginning. And then ultimately, maybe because of that, their children might choose another profession.
Well,
or not profession, but another type of work.
They could also learn from the tobacco industry, too. I mean, after all, those folks have become a condemned industry, at least as far as scientific evidence and government policy and national policy are concerned, and so they have made adjustments in the tobacco industry, and when we get the same kind of warnings on beef that we have on cigarettes, I'm sure the people in the beef industry and the dairy industry will adjust just like the people in the tobacco industry have.
I would think so. I would hope so. I just think that Americans who unfortunately grow up watching television, motion pictures, day in and day out, video cassettes now, where there is so much slaughter of human beings, I would hope that they would recognize that if we can go back to the very basic thing, and that is not to want to bring death to anything that has eyes or that can run away from you, and realize that is basically right and should be just core in our thinking, that could be the beginning of really a new world order, ultimately. Because as long as we keep killing animals, I have a feeling we're going to keep killing people. Hmm. And there's certainly a relationship there.
Well, certainly when you start killing, it's hard to stop. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that it becomes a habit. And as I said earlier in the program, quoting George Bernard Shaw, custom will reconcile people to any atrocity.
This is Dr. John McDougall on KSRO Radio 1350, and my very interesting, very moving guest is Casey Casey.